Hey, I want to start today with a public service announcement. I am currently right in the middle of what I think is the worst stomach virus God has ever seen fit to walk me through. Yesterday, I spent some time in the seventh level of hell. And so I say that to say, first off, if there's anything that you wanted to say to me after this service or shake my hand or whatever, don't do that, because I would not wish the last 24 hours of my worst enemy. Secondly, say a prayer for me. I'm a little low on energy this morning, and now you know why. And so, you know, if you hear something you like and you feel like responding, you know, you feel free to pick your pastor up. Anyway, my name's Ryan, and I want to welcome you to week three of our service, our series called Navigate. And what we're doing, we're finishing out the summer in this series, looking at five passages that can help us navigate some of the most difficult and confusing areas of life. And today we're going to talk about navigating something that constitutes a huge part of our lives. Statistically, it's going to take up one-third of the time that you spend on this planet. We're going to talk about navigating work. And to do that, we're going to be in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. Before I read that, though, I just want to make a comment about it on the front end. So this passage you're going to see is addressed to a very specific group of people. Peter's writing it to household slaves. Now, when you hear that, you might be wondering what a passage written to household slaves has to do with you, or what you could possibly get out of a passage like that, since I'm guessing nobody's clocking in as a household slave tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And so I just want to speak to that on the front end of this talk. It's really important to understand when you look at the concept of slavery, specifically in the New Testament, it really is nothing like the slavery that comes to mind in North American history, for three main reasons. First off, in the Roman Empire, slavery was not based on race. So it was never as though if you look a certain way, then you're automatically a slave. Secondly, slavery was not for a lifetime. The vast majority of slaves were freed by the time that they were 30 years old. But thirdly, and probably most significantly, and this is what makes a passage like this really relevant for people like us, while you were a slave in the Roman Empire, you could actually save up your money and earn and kind of store that away so that you could one day purchase your freedom. And a lot of slaves, once they did that, they would turn around and they would adopt the family that they worked for, and then they would continue to work for them as a free person, which just goes to show how favorable the conditions were for a lot of slaves in the Roman Empire. And so it was for this reason, strange as it might sound to us in our context, it was for this reason that a lot of people actually voluntarily sold themselves into slavery in Peter's day. Because in doing so, you had job security that often was pretty tough to find elsewhere, but you also had room for promotion and advancement and all those kinds of things. And so if you're wondering, you know, how a passage directed at household slaves, if you're wondering what that has to do with you, it's because household slaves were basically, household slavery was almost an internship. And so household slaves in a lot of ways are viewed in exactly the same light as employees in our culture. So every principle that we pull out of this passage today can be used by us and taken into the workplace. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, navigating work. And to do that, there's a specific question that I kind of want to ask on the front end of this teaching that we're going to spend the morning answering. That question is this. It's, how should I approach my work when I don't feel valued or find value in it? Now, the vast majority of people that I talk to fall into one or both of those camps. Either, the people that you work for consistently remind you that you're not very valued by them or the corporation, which if that's you, you know how difficult it is to keep showing up in a culture like that. Or maybe your bosses are really great to work for. It's just that you struggle often with finding purpose and meaning and value in what it is that you do. And if you fall into either one of those camps, this text and this talk today, I think, is going to be very helpful to you. So we're going to be in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. We'll pick it up in verse 18, which says this: household slaves, submit with all fear to your masters, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the cruel. So the first thing Peter says here is to submit, not just to good and gentle masters, but also to the cruel ones. Now, The Greek word that gets translated cruel here literally means crooked. So this can be a boss who takes credit from you that you do deserve. It can be a boss who assigns blame to you that you do not deserve. Or it can simply be a boss that just abuses their position of authority and lords it over you and mistreats you in some way, shape, or form. And what Peter's saying on the front end here is submit even to that kind of boss. Now, the Bible never teaches that it's wrong to quit your job or to look for a better opportunity elsewhere, but the heart of this command is calling you and I to do what it is our hands find to do to the best of our ability while we're doing it. In other words, this is going to be our first idea this morning, the first principle we can take into the workplace. It's right here. Don't let the character of your boss determine the quality of your work. So you hear me talk about this all the time. I was a firefighter 4 years before I came here. One of the last days in the fire academy, one of my instructors came to me and told me that I was going to be going to the 1st Battalion, which was a good thing and a bad thing all at once. The 1st Battalion was the best place to go for experience. It's where you run the most fires and the worst accidents and all that kind of stuff. But it was also where the most senior members of the department tended to gravitate. Which is it's an intimidating enough reality getting out of the academy and into the real world, but doing so with really senior members of the department, you know, it makes it even worse. And so I actually landed on a shift with a number of people who had been in the fire service longer than I'd been breathing. And on my particular shift, I just think God's got a sense of humor. My particular shift, I was working with two guys that were 6'4 and weighed more than 300 pounds, could break an elevator by themselves. So I feel like a lollipop kid walking around the firehouse with him. So it was really an intimidating place to work. But what made matters a lot worse for me was that the county was broke when I was a firefighter. And so for 4 years after I got out into the field, four years went by and they had not hired another academy class, which meant not only was I the rookie, but I was the permanent rookie for 4 years. And I don't mean to alarm anybody, but in fire department culture, rookies are not afforded the greatest deal of respect. So what that meant was for 4 years, I didn't have anybody to hand the squeegee off to or yell at or take anything out on. It just all fell on me. And that all the menial tasks landed directly on me. And I feel like, you know, I could kind of play that game and kind of grin and bear it. I think I did a pretty good job of that. But for whatever reason, the stars kind of aligned and I had an experience a couple years in that almost broke me. It was like my breaking point. And it, you know, as I tell this story, it's probably something that I'm sure all of you can sympathize with in one way, shape, or form. So I remember one morning I was cleaning the firehouse, and it had taken me like 4.5 hours to do. And my firehouse wasn't that big, and it shouldn't have taken 4.5 hours to clean it, but it did for two reasons. First off, because no one else wanted to help me. But secondly, because a few people actually wanted to make it more difficult than it needed to be. So I remember as I was going about my business that morning, one of my esteemed colleagues had decided to cook himself breakfast and in a very passive-aggressive manner left all of the pots and pans out that he dirtied and just kind of stared at me and threw them in the sink. And I said, all right, roger that. I'll play the game. I remember one of the other guys was checking Facebook, and the other guy, I don't know what he was doing. I just know he wasn't helping me. And so after a couple of years of this, it was starting to get a little bit old. But what happened next really, you know, kind of, it just got me, and as I find myself revisiting this story, I know I haven't quite healed yet, so perhaps God will give that to me this morning. So I spent 4.5 hours cleaning this firehouse by myself with a smile on my face, and we went out for an errand, you know, just before noon, and as we got off the apparatus, one of my coworkers turned to me, looked me in the eye, and said, you know, Cox, it's time for you to start contributing around here. So I had an aneurysm. I lost several years of my life from that experience. But I tell that story knowing that everybody that I'm talking to can sympathize with a scenario like that in some way, shape, or form. If you've ever worked for anybody, and even if you haven't, I think about like stay-at-home moms with things like this. I think this probably applies to you more than anybody else. But if you have ever worked for somebody, then you know what it's like for your work to go unappreciated. Anybody say amen to that? Yeah. You know what it's like to feel like you're being taken advantage of, to feel like people don't value you. And maybe you know what it's like personally to just really like go all in and lay it out on an assignment just for, you know, somebody else like your boss to kind of swoop in and steal all the credit. And you just know how exhausting, how quickly something like that can take the wind out of your sail. And really what Peter is doing is he's speaking directly to a situation like that. And what he's saying here is don't let the kind of boss your boss is determine the kind of employee that you are. Now, I don't have to tell you how difficult a command like this is because it goes against the grain of our hearts. Because the natural tendency of the human heart is when we get hit to hit back harder. In other words, when we are treated in a way that we feel is unacceptable, then we respond in kind. And so if we feel like our boss doesn't really deserve a good day's work, then we'll give him what we feel he or she deserves. And in the face of that, what Peter is saying is, don't let the character of your boss determine the quality of your work. Now, as difficult as a command like that is to actually walk out with any kind of endurance, when I looked at this week, I was just asking myself the question, well, what happens if we don't operate this way? What happens if we just completely disregard this? What would that look like across a culture? What would it look like in your life? Really, two things will happen if you just completely disregard 1 Peter 2:18. First off, if you decide that you will let the character of your boss determine the quality of your work, and you go into work saying, I'm only going to do the job I think I should do if my boss treats me the way I think I should be treated, then what will happen is you will have voluntarily handed control over your life to another person. What you'll say is, my boss has total control over me to set the tone for the kind of person that I become. Now that, ironically, is the essence of slavery. And so the kind of submission that the Bible calls us to here is really the essence of freedom. It's refusing to let another person dictate the type of person that you become. But secondly, if you let the character of your boss determine the quality of your work, the other thing that will happen is you'll be unemployed. And the reason that I say that is because no matter who your boss is, as long as you work for a human, they're going to let you down sooner or later in one way, shape, or form. And if you allow that to really be, you know, the North Star of the way that you approach work, then you're going to quit or get fired from every job you take. And I say that because the Bible is remarkably clear that even at their best, people just aren't that good. And when you put them in a position of authority, they usually get even worse. So the first principle or concept that this passage would have us taken into work on Monday morning is not to let the character of your boss determine the quality of your work. Here's what we read next. Verse 19 says, "For it brings favor if, mindful of God's will, someone endures grief from suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if you sin and are punished and you endure it. But when you do what is good and suffer, if you endure it, this brings favor with God." This is going to be our next idea this morning, and this is really specifically aimed at people who have trouble finding value in what they do. Here's the principle I want to pull out of this. It's our second idea. See the real value in your work. In every society that people have ever put together, there's always been a value system of occupations, lines of employment, meaning every society, you know, in some way, shape, or form determines what types of work are valuable and what aren't. So, like today, if you go to the Far East, that's a teaching job. In the Far East, if you're a teacher, that's considered a very valuable line of work. That's a line of work that's very meaningful and purposeful and is therefore bestowed a great deal of honor. In the West, in our culture, you know, that's usually, if you think about like, well, what do parents want their kids to grow up to be? That's usually like a doctor or a lawyer. If you say that, you kind of get to, you know, stick your chest out a little bit. And then with that, every society also determines which lines of work are a lot less valuable. But what's interesting is even within Christianity, we've managed to do this. Even within Christianity, we've managed to determine what lines of work are sacred and what lines of work are secular. As though, you know, if you do full-time ministry or you do something with an overt spiritual connotation, like for instance my line of work, that's somehow more valuable than, you know, this secular world. This might surprise you to hear, but the Bible never makes that distinction anywhere. And it's passages like the one that we're reading right now that prove that. What Peter is saying here, this is an incredible thing all by itself. What Peter is saying here is that there is a way in which you can approach your job so as to bring God's favor in your life. Now, I promise you that you don't clock into work on Monday morning with that in the forefront of your mind. Nobody does. But that's what the Bible is saying here. That means that all forms of work can have a spiritual connotation to it, and all forms of work can have an eternal value to them, regardless of what that is. But what's more amazing to me than just what Peter's saying here is who he's saying it to. Because don't forget that this passage is directed specifically to household slaves. The idea that a household slave could do anything that was valuable in God's eyes was a revolutionary concept that no other belief system besides Christianity was teaching, at least in Peter's day. Just to give you an idea of how looked down on and devalued by society household slaves were, we actually know this, that in Peter's day, it was common for Jewish men to start the day by thanking God that he had not made them three things. Jewish men would start the day thanking God that he'd not made them a Gentile, a woman, or a slave. That shows you exactly how looked down on by society those three groups of people are. Now, what that means is that nobody dreamed of being a household slave when they grew up. It means that no household slave got out of bed in the morning with a sense of pride in what they did or the belief that their work had any value in society's eyes, let alone in God's eyes. Because household slaves, and I touched on this in my intro, household slaves viewed their work as basically a means to an end. They viewed it as something that they had to do so that they could just get through it and then one day live the life that they really wanted to live. Here's what's really interesting. That's how just about everybody views their job in our culture today. Most people view their work exactly the way that a household slave viewed their work. They don't find any meaning in it, any purpose in it, any value in it. It's basically a necessary evil so that they can pay the bills, they can get out of debt, they can pay for their daughter's weddings, they can get the 401, the pension, the benefits, and then one day live the life that they really want to live that we call the American dream. If you view work that way, you view work exactly the way that a household slave did, and this passage is really meant to speak directly to that mindset. Because what this is saying in no uncertain terms is that every form of work has an intrinsic value to it. Because every form of work, even that of a household slave, can bring the favor of God into your life. Now, that of course does not mean that you can earn your salvation through work, but what it does absolutely mean, in no uncertain terms, is that you can approach your work in a way that is meaningful to God, that is pleasing to God, and in a way that will be rewarded by God. And the way that you do that, according to verses 19 and 20, is basically determined by the way that you walk through suffering that you did nothing to deserve. Now, the natural default of the human heart, we hate suffering. We avoid suffering like the plague. The worst case scenario is to experience suffering that you didn't do anything to deserve. What this passage is saying is that every time you walk through that, when you're mistreated, when you're treated unfairly, when you're denied justice, that's an opportunity to bring more of God's favor into your life. Nobody naturally thinks like that, but that's what this is saying. And when you walk through that and when you endure the grief that comes from unjust suffering, that's what happens. Now, if you want a picture of what this can look like, there's no greater picture of it, no clearer picture of it in my mind than the story of Joseph in the Old Testament. So the story of Joseph begins with, he's a young man, he's got a number of brothers, and he's the favorite son of his father. And so his brothers conspire against him. They betray him, and they sell him into slavery in a foreign culture. So he goes from favorite son of his dad to the bottom of the food chain in a foreign culture overnight. Once he's there, because he was very gifted when it comes to leadership skills, he wound up becoming a household slave to one of Pharaoh's officers, but got promoted very quickly through the ranks to the point that he was basically in charge of all that Pharaoh's officer had to his name. So all things considered, it wasn't a very bad life, but one day, his boss's wife came on to him, And he was a man of integrity, and so he literally ran away from her when she tried to do that, because that wasn't the kind of man that he was. But she was so, you know, angered by that, that she turned around and told everybody that Joseph was in fact the one that came on to her. And so who are you going to believe, the foreign slave or the boss's wife? And so Joseph got thrown into prison. And then his life, you know, basically went from, you know, he thought that was rock bottom, getting sold into slavery. Now he's found a whole new rock bottom. But the same thing basically happened. The warden noticed that he had leadership and administrative skills, and so it wasn't very long before he was basically the boss of all the prisoners. And then they noticed that he had this unique ability, a supernatural ability to interpret dreams. And so while he's in prison, he interprets the dream of a man who was shortly thereafter released from prison. And so just before he gets out, Joseph tells him, hey, put in a good word for me when you're out there. I don't even belong in here. And the guy whose dream he interpreted said, okay, you know, I'll do that. And then, of course, as soon as he got to the other side, he totally forgot about Joseph. And so Joseph was left in prison for another 2 years. Now, before I get to the end of Joseph's story and explain how God's favor turned everything around for him, let me just really take a look at what Joseph experienced, because I'm willing to bet he experienced things that you have personally experienced, because they're things that happen in workplaces all the time. All right, Joseph's story begins with him being sold into slavery by his brothers. In other words, he was betrayed by people he thought he could trust. And maybe you know what that's like. Maybe you've had people that you thought you could count on, people that you thought were your friends, people that you thought would be there for you, and they weren't. And not only were they not there for you, but you found out maybe they put a knife in your back. Right, then Joseph is in, he's the household slave of one of Pharaoh's officers, and he gets wrongly accused of a crime he didn't commit. Right, now what that is, that's character assassination. That's people deliberately misrepresenting him. And that's a whole lot of people making up their mind about the type of person that Joseph was without bothering to get to know him. Now maybe you can sympathize with that as well. Maybe you know what it's like for people to gossip about you, to run your name through the mud, to slander you, to determine things about you without giving you the opportunity to defend yourself or show them who you really are. If that's you, you know how painful that is. But then after Joseph is in prison and he correctly interpreted that dream, what happened was he was denied recognition. He was passed over. He was forgotten about. So what you have in Joseph's life is the story of a guy who was denied recognition that he did deserve. He was handed blame that he did not deserve, and he was betrayed by people that he thought he could trust. But by the end of Joseph's story, what you saw is that although it took a lot of time, like it so often does, and although it was basically unseen while it was happening, as it so often is, what we see is that God's hand was at work in Joseph's life the entire time. And what God's favor did in Joseph's life was it saw fit to get Joseph promoted to the second in command over Egypt, so that Joseph was in a position to save hundreds, if not thousands of families, including his own family, from a famine that had struck the land. And what you see in Joseph's life is this promise in 1 Peter on display, that when we walk through injustices that we did nothing to deserve, in a way where we keep our eyes on God and in a way that honors God, not only does God see what we are going through, but it brings his favor in our lives. Now, here's what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that if you're mistreated on Monday morning and handle it well, you're going to get promoted to second in command of Egypt. I can say with relative certainty, that's definitely not going to happen. But what I am saying, because what this passage is saying, is that if you walk through it in a way that honors God, it will bring God's favor into your life. Now, that might mean that God completely changes your situation. It might mean that God changes you in the midst of your situation. But what it absolutely means either way is that you will bring God's favor into your life. But what's so important here is to understand that this won't happen by default. This doesn't happen automatically. First off, Peter's very explicit here. This doesn't happen if you're the cause of your own suffering. Right? If you screw up and then you have to, you know, pay the penalty for that, that doesn't mean a whole lot. But what he's also saying here is just being treated unfairly does not automatically translate to anything in your life. What unlocks the favor of God in our life, according to this passage, is when we bear up. What we have to do, what this passage is calling us to do, is something that is impossible for the human heart to do on its own. We have to bear up under and endure suffering that we did nothing to deserve. Now, I'll just speak on a personal note here. It's hard enough for me to suffer when I know I'm the cause of my suffering. And the vast majority of times in my life, I have been the cause of my own suffering. I'm still not very good at walking through it well when it's on me. So how on earth can anybody walk through suffering that they did nothing to deserve? And that's exactly where this passage ends. If you look at verse 21, it says, "For you were called to this because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you should follow in his steps." This is going to be our third, and it'll be our last idea this morning. It's that Jesus has already done what he has called us to do. Now, the reason that I think passages like this one specifically are so important for us to look at and think through on a Sunday morning is because passages like this explicitly show us how a relationship with Jesus really can and really should redefine every area of our lives. Because what Peter's doing here is he's writing to household slaves, teaching them how to contextualize the gospel to change the way that they endure mistreatment on their job. Most people don't think that a relationship with Jesus has a whole lot to do with their work life in general, let alone that a relationship with Jesus can change how you deal with mistreatment on your job. But that's what this text is showing. So what it's saying here is that we have Jesus as an example when we experience mistreatment and injustice on our jobs. But the more that I studied this verse, specifically verse 21, the more that I believe example is not the best translation of the Greek word Peter uses here. Because the Greek word that Peter uses that gets translated example in my version, it actually referred to a tool that would teach little kids how to write in the Roman Empire. It was called a hippogrammos. So in Peter's day, they didn't have paper, and papyrus was way too expensive to just let a child scribble on and figure out the alphabet. So what they would do is hand a child a small wooden frame, and they would fill it with colored wax. And then the child's teacher, whoever was teaching them the alphabet, would take a stylus, and he would write in the wax the letters of the alphabet. So the child would then take that, and he would trace where his teacher had written with his own hand so that his own hand could learn the shapes of the letters of the alphabet. And that perfect line of writing that the teacher's hand had written, which was called the hippogrammos, that's what would teach the child the alphabet. It was literally translated, what that word means is the overwriting. Now, for Peter here to say that we need Jesus as our hippogrammos in the context of suffering well means at least two things for us that are so important for us to understand. What it means first and foremost is that you and I stand no better of a chance at learning how to walk through suffering well apart from Jesus. We stand no better of a chance at that apart from Jesus than a child did at guessing how to write the letters of the alphabet without anybody teaching them. It's just not going to happen. But what this little analogy here that Peter's using also means is that we need to have a deeply intimate relationship with Jesus. We need to learn to use Jesus the way that a child learned to use this writing tool. Because it's not like a child would just look at what their teacher wrote and then go to their own tablet and try to write it on their own. They had to overlay the teacher's writing on their own tablet. And what that's showing us is that you and I need a whole lot more than to just think about Jesus, or hear about Jesus, or look at Jesus from time to time. We need to overlay who Jesus is and what he has done for us on our own lives. And just the way that a teacher had to write into that wax the letters of the alphabet, the truth of the gospel needs to be written onto our hearts until it sinks down so deeply, until it resonates so deeply with who we are on a fundamental level, that it causes us to respond in different ways when suffering becomes a part of our reality. And the way that you do this, the way that you use the finished work of Jesus as this writing tool, is just by reminding your own heart of everything that Peter says to close out this text. So I'm going to read verses 22 through 25 to you. And while I do this, I'd like to call the worship team back up. It says this: "Jesus did not commit sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he was suffering, he did not threaten, but entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that having died to sins, we might live for righteousness. You have been healed by his wounds. For you were like sheep going astray, but you have now returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. This passage ends reminding us of the truth of the gospel. And the reason for that is because the truth of the gospel is the greatest resource that we have at our disposal when we walk through suffering, specifically suffering that we did nothing to deserve. See, what every other major religion and every god of every major religion and every religious figure and every other major religion all has in common is that they demand that we figure out whatever we need to figure out and work through whatever we need to work through in order to get to them, to make it to them. And when you hold up the teachings of Christianity alongside every other major religion, you see how different the message of Jesus is. Because in Jesus, what we do not have is a God that demands we get to him. What we have in Jesus is a Savior who was willing to come to us. And more than just coming to us, what we just read there is that in Jesus, we have a Savior who was willing to suffer for us. Not just alongside us, but in our place. What we have in Jesus is a Savior who took the suffering that you and I deserved at Calvary. And until you can really grapple with that and understand that and give yourself to that, you're never going to be able to walk through suffering correctly. Until you realize that Jesus has experienced the ultimate suffering that you deserved in your place, suffering's going to have the power over you to make you bitter or cynical or angry or turn you into a person that you don't want to become. But it's by understanding what we just read in these final verses that suffering really begins to only have the power to refine us. Because in Jesus, we have two truths to hold on to the next time that we walk through something difficult. In Jesus, what Jesus did at the cross means that we're never alone in our suffering because we have a high priest who can sympathize with our needs. But in rising again from the grave, what that means is that in Jesus, suffering will never have the final word for us. And it's as those two truths sink deeply into our hearts that we gain the ability to walk through mistreatment and injustice and suffering that we've done nothing to deserve in a way that doesn't just honor God, but it brings his favor into our lives. So how should you approach your work when you don't feel valued or find value in it? There's three things that we see in this passage. First off, we cannot allow the character of our boss to determine the quality of our work. We do what God has given us to do to the absolute best of our ability. Secondly, we need to learn to see the real value in our work, that there is a way that we can approach any line of work, whatever it is, in a way that has eternal value and significance to it. And the way that we do that is by enduring suffering, by looking to Jesus, who has already been through for us everything that he calls us to walk through in him. That's it. That's all.